Hi everyone. Before we get started today, I want to talk to you about our newest partner, BetterHelp. Throughout my own grieving process, I have found therapy to be critical in getting me to the point where I am today, and I truly cannot imagine getting through this past year without it. A lot of the world is still in some sort of quarantine or phased opening, and BetterHelp is a perfect platform for accessing therapy during this time because you can do it from wherever you are. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with a licensed professional therapist, and you can have your first session scheduled in as little as 24 hours, which is huge. I know for a lot of people, you hit a roadblock in starting therapy because there's a pressure to really find the right fit. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. It's really easy to change a counselor if you feel like you want a better fit. The therapist you're matched with is available weekly, but you can send messages anytime through the app and get responses between sessions, which makes such a big difference, especially when you are processing a loss. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and they also have financial aid available, which I love and is one of the reasons that I decided to partner with them. We have a special offer for the Grief Coach listeners where you'll get 10% off your first month at trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach. That's trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach. You can join over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of experienced professionals. Investing in yourself is so important. If you've listened to any of the previous episodes, you know how much I prioritize doing the work to get through the grief process, and BetterHelp is a wonderful platform to leverage to do so. Go to trybetterhelp.com/thegriefcoach to get started. Hi everyone, this is Brooke James. Welcome to The Grief Coach. If it is your first time listening, I'm so glad you're here. And if you've listened before, welcome back. Today we are in for quite the story. Jan Canty, who is an author and a podcaster, is with us today. Jan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So I would love for you to share with the audience a bit about what is your grief story. We can just get right into it because I think the audience will find your story very interesting, very valuable. So I want to get right to it.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like a movie, but it does. I was a person leading a very extremely ordinary life when it fell apart. I was married to a man 18 years older than me who was a psychologist. And to kind of fast forward, in July of 1984, unbeknownst to me, he began a secret life, which he proceeded to continue to have for 18 months downtown in Detroit. He was handing out money to this couple to, I guess you could say, support their drug lifestyle in exchange for an audience. And looking back at it, the motive appeared to be, the more I advanced in my education, the more intimidated he got. And I eventually not only got a PhD, but I went through a postdoctoral fellowship, which he wasn't happy with. And I think he just sought out an audience that would admire him the way I used to look at him, probably. At any rate, he ran out of money, and their reaction was not a positive one. They clubbed him to death, and they dismembered him. All I knew was that he didn't come home one night. I knew nothing about this. Mm-hmm. I reported him missing. At first, they didn't do anything about it. But a week later, I was called down to Detroit Police Homicide, and they told me a little bit. They didn't have his body yet, but they told me that about his background and what he'd been up to, which all was news to me, which made me feel really foolish and naive, and like, why was I not seeing any of this? Mm-hmm. And at any rate, they eventually arrested the two defendants who did not succeed in trial and were both convicted. The man who actually did the murder was given life without the chance of parole. He had tried to escape. He succeeded for only a little bit of hours and then was reapprehended. The woman
did
not.
Oh my God.
The woman did not serve much time because she didn't actually do the murder. She did the cleanup and the help and lied to the police, etc. At any rate, the media went nuts and I was hounded day and night. I had so many fires to put out, and it seemed like the harder I tried to do that, the more popped up. And eventually, after a year and a half of this, I just said I'd had enough. I'd even tried moving, changing my name, changing my phone number. I decided it was enough, and I was not going to let that define me. And if I was going to have a normal life, I had to leave Detroit, which I hated to do because it's my hometown. All my friends were there. And despite how it sounds and how you might think, there's a lot of positive things that go on in Detroit as well. So at any rate, I did. I pulled up stakes, changed my name, moved deep into the Midwest where nobody knew me. And I taught, instead of doing clinical work, I taught college, and I absolutely loved it. The people were wonderful, but the climate was really harsh. It was worse than Detroit, and I eventually moved again to the West Coast. And now I'm remarried, and I adopted two special needs children whose mother was murdered, and that's why the social worker thought we would be a good match, because I understood it from the inside out. And I basically didn't talk about it for 30 years. My children knew nothing about it. My second husband only knew a little bit about it until I wrote the book. And he did not want to read the manuscript until it was finished, but I would tell him bits and pieces, and he got so angry about it, not at me, but about what happened, that I could see it clearly upset him. So we didn't talk a lot about it. But one of the points I want to raise about this is that this happened back in 85, the murderer did, and there was no help for homicide survivors then. I didn't even know the term homicide survivor. There was no grief support groups. There was no victims advocates. There was no victim impact statements. There was nothing. We were a nuisance in the courtroom. Thank God I had Detective Landeros, because she was my guardian angel through this whole thing. Even when I had to go identify him at the morgue, she came with me and helped me identify what they found of him. And I don't know how I could have done it without her. But three events happened almost simultaneously, which kind of called me out of my shell to speak up about it. One was that coincidentally, we had a coworker missing at work. And people were coming up to me and saying, oh, could you imagine having somebody you care about missing? And I'm going, oh, no, I can't imagine that. Knowing full well I'm lying. The second thing that happened was about that same week, we had a seminar at work by a physician. And I don't remember the exact topic of what he came to speak about. But one of the aside comments that this physician made was, people who have a secret and carry it with them for years pay a price physically. And I had been just diagnosed with cancer, so that rang a bell. And then I went back to my office to kind of sit down and look at those two pieces, you know, the missing person at work and what he said in his seminar. And I glanced over at my bookshelf, and there's a collection of books that I had assembled over the years, all about people who've gone through horrific situations and come out intact. People like called 33 Men, that was the Chilean miners who were trapped underground for 69 days. There was held hostage a woman whose little girl, she was a bank manager, and her home had an invasion, and they strapped dynamite to her daughter's back if she didn't break the safe open for them in the morning. And she came through it. And I started looking at those books, and I started thinking about, I started feeling like I was leading a second life, a fake life, because nobody knew about what had happened. And it would have explained a lot why I was so cautious about safety and hypervigilant to the sound of noises and wouldn't go to baseball games, because that's the tool they used to club him with, was a baseball bat. At any rate, those three things came together, and I decided, you know, if they can write about it, I can write about it. So I spent the good part of 4 to 5 years writing this and rewriting this book. And in the process discovered, you know what, there's a whole tribe of us out there of homicide survivors. And like your show, I cannot emphasize enough to anybody listening how important it is to connect. How important it is to speak with people who understand the journey you've been on. Isolating doesn't do it. Putting it in the underground of your life doesn't do it. You've got to connect with people that get it in order to move forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing all of that. I have so many questions and want to go so many directions for our conversation, but we could take a step back and go back to that lack of connection. You and I were just talking about this before we started recording. When murder is in the media, the victim and the perpetrators are the ones who are the focus, and it's not the family who is left behind, the friends who are left behind, whether of the perpetrator or the victim. If you could kind of talk about some of that experience and what that was like. Grief is already isolating.
Yes.
And I would assume that grief after finding out that your husband lived a double life, like I'm sure there was a lot of conflict of how to grieve when you also felt betrayed. Can you tell the audience a little bit about that experience and how did you get through that when it was happening?
I attribute a lot of my ability to get through it to two things. One is my parents, and two is the Detective Landeros. I have terrific parents, and they raised me to believe in myself and be strong and always look at the fact that there is something that could be worse, as bad as this sounds. And as a result, kind of as an aside, when I mentioned I was teaching undergraduate psychology, I was teaching cross-cultural psychology, and I thought, you know, if I'm going to do a good job of that, I better start traveling the world. And I did, and I used my photography, and I went to remote villages on five continents over the years. And boy, I'll tell you, does that put things in perspective? My problems were nothing compared to what I observed. As a woman, I have rights. A man cannot rape me and walk away and brag about it and be fine. I have the right to medical care if I'm in an emergency situation. We have paved roads. We have clean water. We don't have a civil war, although the last month it looks like we do. but you know, it really put it in perspective. In the early times, it was very isolating, especially after my parents they were from Arizona, so they had to go back eventually. They couldn't live with me. They had their life there and they went back. And it was so isolating. People withdrew from me. They didn't know what to say. I mean, our culture does not handle death well, regardless of the circumstances.
Not at all, no.
and people either don't say anything or say something stupid or fear they'll say something stupid, and as a result, they avoid you. And in truth, I avoided them as well because I was so absorbed with putting out fires. I didn't have time to think about them and their issues. I was worried about my next mortgage payment. He had bankrupted us. I was worried about the fact that he had given them a photo album of the contents of my house, which I had assembled in the case of a fire. They knew the layout of my house. They knew what was in my house.
Oh my God.
I didn't know who they had given it to, you know?
Yeah.
So this stuff kept me up at night. And I did not have the luxury of thinking about other people's feelings at that point. I just avoided people. I was so isolating. This is going to sound really strange, but the point I'm trying to make here with this little thing I'm going to tell you is how isolating I felt. There was a time maybe 6 months later where I had to go to the dentist and he had to, you know, pry in my mouth, right? And I remember sitting there and when he touched my face, how good it felt. It was the first time someone had touched me. I mean, it wasn't in a romantic way. It wasn't even in a friendship way. But just to have human touch was so welcoming. And I started crying. And he thought I was in pain. And I said, no, it's my eyes are just watering. I just kind of gave a silly excuse. But that's how isolating I felt, is just to have human touch again was amazing.
Yeah. And that's something I'm sure people can relate to who are quarantining alone. Like I know I didn't, like, I hugged a friend, I think 2.5 months into the pandemic, but it was the first time I live alone. It was the first time I had touched another person. And it just like, you don't realize until you don't have it of like
exactly.
How much you miss human touch. And right. I know like you mentioned, and I've mentioned previously on the show, like so many people don't know how to speak about death and comfort the bereaved. And I found comfort in people just like hugging me or having an arm around me or holding my hand. And like, we wouldn't have to say anything.
No.
Going through it alone after your parents left town after the trial, I can't imagine.
Yeah, it was pretty isolating. And I think that people expect that there's some magic words that they need to come up with. They don't. You're right. They can just sit there with you.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, if they really want to help, is offer to do something concrete. Don't say, call me if you need me, because your mind's a blitz. You don't know what you need. But
Absolutely.
To say, look, like Mike, I had a friend whose husband suicided, and I know she was fretting about her lawn care. She was not able to do it physically herself. I paid for her lawn care for the summer. That was a huge thing for her, minor for me. And it didn't even involve me really, except to write a check, but it was huge for her. Mm-hmm. So if people could say, look, I'll take your cat to the vet, or I will have your tires rotated on your car for you, rather than say, call me if you need me, is a huge thing. I think the other thing I would strongly urge people to do is there's a lot of sympathy and a lot of support initially. But boy, after about 6 to 8 weeks, that fades and people go back to their lives and you're left there in the rubble. And that's mm-hmm. when people really need to check in with you and say, how you doing? I haven't forgotten. I'd like to drop by, or do you want to go out for coffee, or whatever it is that they want to say. But don't ignore the person after that initial gush of support. Mm-hmm. A point I want to return to that you raised is the conflicted grief piece.
Yes, thank you.
The conflicted grief, there's many kinds of grief, and one of which is conflicted, where you feel ambivalent. It's like some relief in the grief. That is a taboo topic. Nobody talks about it. You're not going to find a Hallmark card in the store addressing it. And because somebody who's betrayed you so badly makes you feel so angry because he brought this on himself, and me secondarily, there isn't this, oh my God, I wish I'd come back in my life and things could go back to the way they were. Oh no, I do not want them to go back the way they were. It was horrible. I mean, in retrospect.
And you have any inkling that he was living this double life?
Nope.
None. So you were dealing with shock and conflicting grief.
Right. Oh, God. He was old, as I said, older than me, and he had withdrawn, and he was getting more surly, never abusive, but surly. And I attributed that to his age. I thought, well, you know, he is 18 years older than me, maybe. And I kept urging him to get a physical. And he was like, I'm fine. You know, guys are about that anyway. And so, no, I had no clue. And so with conflicted grief, you have a tremendous amount of guilt that you swallow, because you're not supposed to say anything or think anything ill of the dead. And so there you sit and you're having to fake it, like, oh yeah, I really feel sorrow and I really feel grief. And that is there, but that's not the total picture.
Right.
And it's not unique to this situation. And I knew of an older couple whose adult son had pretty much bankrupted them because of his drug abuse. They'd put him through chemical dependency treatment couple of times, for which he kept relapsing. He'd bring his friends over. They'd steal stuff from him. They threatened his parents at one point, and he eventually died of a drug overdose. Well, I know in their hearts of hearts, there was a part of them that went, phew, even though they could never admit that publicly. Sure. And so I don't think it's unique to my situation. I think there is more frequency of conflicted grief than people acknowledge in this culture, and it's very difficult to deal with subjectively because you feel so guilty, but it's the real, and that certainly added to my isolation as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that your situation seems pretty concrete of like why you would feel conflicted, but I think that similarly, as you said with addicts, similarly with if someone leaves their finances a mess and you have to play detective or fix stuff where you had no idea, like you just had a tough relationship with them. Like people have tough relationships with family and friends all the time. And so really to the audience, is there any advice you have on like how you worked through that or accepted that like, no, it's okay that I am mad?
Well, I got away. As I said, I traveled the world. That helped. And then when I finally moved away and I had time to exhale, I looked at the whole thing and I thought, you know, he paid the ultimate price. I didn't. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I didn't cause any of this to happen. I believed in him. I'm not responsible for what happened. And I'm entitled to my feelings. And I refuse to be collateral damage. I refuse. They've taken enough from me, those two or three, however you want to word it. And I'm not going to be collateral damage anymore. I have done enough. Mm-hmm. I wish somebody would have said back when it happened, to get back to this notion of conflicted grief, I wish anybody would have said to me, you know, with all that's happened, I bet it's tough for you to know how to feel. I bet your grief is really complicated. Yeah. I wish somebody would have said that, because that acknowledges both sides of it without saying good for you. Or, I mean, I was not going to badmouth him. I was not going to publicly badmouth the two that even did this to him, because I thought they don't deserve that attention from me. I won't even speak their names. Mm-hmm. But I wish somebody would have acknowledged the quandary I was in, but nobody did. And so I would urge your listeners to open the door for that conversation. The person may not want to respond, but at least you've opened the door to it.
Right. And like, it does so much when grieving, but also all the time to feel acknowledged.
Yes.
I love that advice. Thank you. Something that I know you've talked about in your podcast, and I haven't read your book because we just started talking with not enough time for me to read this. If you could talk about, because I think this is something that people, most people don't experience, but maybe now there's, I think, probably pieces of it with social media, but you were in really a media storm. Anything that you're comfortable sharing about what that felt like, I don't want to put words in your mouth of like disrespect from the media, but an invasion of privacy maybe is a better way to put it, and how you dealt with that and just what that was like.
I wish I knew then what I know now. I would have handled it better. It was awful. I mean, just to give you a couple ideas of how voracious their appetite was for details, which they had no right to, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. When I had to go into the morgue, and it was early, early Sunday morning, like 7 a.m, they did, which Detective Landero set up deliberately to give me privacy.
Sure.
We went in, I had to, you know, I went through this awful experience of having to identify his head, and it had been buried for a week. I mean, it wasn't a pretty thing. And I was reeling from what I had just been through. And I'm walking out of the building, and there is a collection of reporters, all with cameras, ready to snap my picture, and microphones jammed at me. And I was like putty. I didn't know. I was exhausted, for one thing. I hadn't slept much in a week, which makes you more vulnerable, too. Thank God I had Detective Landau. She spun me around, and we went out the back door, and she had me lay down in her back seat of her scout car, and we drove off. That was one thing they did. The other thing they did is they, despite my repeated emphasis to the undertaker, do not let them into this funeral. Do not. The media will be here. And I went an hour and a half early. Do not let them in. They don't belong here. This isn't a media event. And I don't want them in here. And I got no assurance from them that they would protect my privacy. In fact, they said things like, well, we can't prohibit, you know, it's a public sidewalk. I go, right, but it's not a public building. Mm-hmm. Anyway, 300 people showed up, many of whom were reporters with their cameras and their notes, and they shoved the cameras in my face at the funeral to the point where I just got up and left. I didn't even wait for it to end. I traded cars with a friend and went home and locked the doors. I mean, there was no end to their appetite, and they were completely disrespectful. In my book, I described them as fruit flies over sangria. That's how they were. My advice now would be get a family spokesperson, tell them what they need to know, and move on. Don't even give them the time of day, as much as I tried not to. I mean, my father, thank God, when he was in town, he answered the door and he answered the phone and he protected me somewhat. But they have no respect for anything. They published a map to my house. They published pictures of my car. They went on and on, so that everywhere I went, I felt like I was under the microscope. But where I really drew the line was when they by doing all of this, they complicated my psychology practice, because in psychology, you have boundaries. You don't discuss where you went to school and where your life was and where you like to eat and how much wine you drink and the kind of car you drive. They published all that, therefore complicating my caseload. And I thought, that's it. I was so mad. And that's when I decided to move.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like that freedom, or did you feel like you were hiding, or maybe a combination of both?
Both. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Having experienced what you did, and again, this is not, well, maybe it is. Maybe first we can talk about, does homicide happen more than people think it does? Is this an experience that you think a lot of people have, but any context as to the frequency of homicide?
On average, the United States has about 18,000 murders a year. For each murder, there is between 8 and 10 homicide survivors that have a deep and immediate reaction to the death. Mm-hmm. Worldwide statistics, that's a drop in the bucket. No, we do not have a lot of murders. In fact, people that follow true crime shows tend to way overestimate the amount, the frequency of murder. It's a pretty rare event, mm-hmm. although in the last 6 months it has increased. But the peak of murders was between 1975 to 1995, and it has gone down steadily since until the last 6 months.
What do you think is the reason, or do you have any thoughts about people have this fascination with like murder and true crime? And like,
they do.
Why do you think that is?
I think if you look at the data of who follows true crime, it is mostly females and mostly between the ages of 25 to 55. That isn't to say men or younger or older people don't look at it, but that's the bulk of the people who purchase true crime movies and books and what. And there has been research on that, and I agree with a lot of the findings, which point out that a lot of the time it is for this feeling of, what do I need to know to make myself safe? It's a voyeuristic way of learning, oh, I won't do that again, or that's a sign I better be aware of. I think it's that. I think for some people, it's also just a break in their boredom. They see it as entertainment, unfortunately, and it's misrepresented in many ways. And I don't see it going away. What bothers me more than that is the trivialization of it. For example, there's products, merchandise you can buy now. There's a cereal spoon out there that's spelled S-E-R-I-A-L, and it says serial killer. Get it? And it's a cereal spoon, C-E-R-E-A-L, you know, for breakfast.
Yeah, so the audience, you can see my jaw just dropped as Jan is telling me this. What?
Yeah, cereal spoon. Or they have, you know, masks at Halloween of serial murderers out there. And it trivializes it. And it does not give any attention to the aftermath that... Mm-hmm. I would press upon somebody to come up with a good movie or book that talks about the aftermath. You know, what happens to the survivors 10, 15, 20, 30 years later? People don't know. It's like, oh, they guess they go back to their life, you know, and pick up where they left off. No, that does not happen. You do not go back to normal. There is no baseline after that. It changes. You have a new normal. I mean, if you think about how much do we know about the families of the murders that were created by Bundy. We don't know much about them, let alone the long-term impact, or Sandy Hook families, or anybody that you can point to. And that's why I wanted a podcast that dealt with that specific issue of what's happened to you 10 years, 15 years later. I've interviewed people of the Boston Marathon bombing and of serial murderer from Panama and others. And there's some similarities in their stories after the years, and or some unique features as well. But that's an unknown, and it's not limited to Hollywood. Research does not inquire into that. For example, the other day I was doing a podcast on an older, she was an older daughter. How can I word this? There was a mother that had a two-year-old that was murdered. She then had another child who is now a young adult. So this young adult never met her older sister, because she was murdered before she was born. And I look, as I usually do, I try to look into the research behind it before I interviewed her. There's almost nothing out there on that. In fact, almost nothing out there on that issue of what is the impact of somebody growing up who's had an older sibling murdered? Mm-hmm. We don't know. Nobody asked the question. But if you look up the personality features of a serial murderer, tons of stuff out there.
Yeah. And that probably comes from a more fascination.
Yeah.
Like a compassion, like you see that in the research.
Right. So podcasts, academic research, and Hollywood, none of them are focusing on homicide and its long-term impact on those left to grieve. And it's not just limited to the family members. It's also limited to first responders, witnesses to a homicide, and coworkers.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I know with this podcast and I believe very strongly that each grief story is unique, but that there are common threads in all of them. Like, has in your podcast and interviewing these survivors, have you found there to be common threads? Was there anything that was surprising to you?
Some of the common threads are probably what you've heard as well. People telling me about the stupid things people say to them. Like, I know just how you feel. My dog died.
Yeah, this is my favorite thing to talk about. So I want after we finish this answer, let's talk about that.
Or the other common denominator is that people feel a reactivity that is to say early on, they might be hypervigilant, jumpy and tearful and stomach upset and clenching their teeth. And those physical symptoms tend to fade a little bit over time. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the nightmares they used to. They don't clench their teeth like they used to. But if something comes along that strongly reminds them of it, yeah, they can jump back into it. That's what trauma does. Your brain never forgets because it's trying to protect you. And it's saying, hey, wake up. That's the very thing that brought the circumstances were then like they are now. So pay attention. That was a common denominator. And another one just is how isolating it is and how relieved they felt to be able to tell their story. And they all hold out the hope that maybe their story can help somebody else, as do I.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if we can talk about some of the things that were the most helpful that people have said to you and some things that were not helpful, because I really think that if I can do one thing with this podcast is to better arm people who are grief adjacent with things to say, mm-hmm. I will consider that to be a success.
Well, one of my friends in New York City called me, a guy I knew from my postdoctoral fellowship, and we were talking at length. He's a great guy. His name is Matthew. And he called me. And again, it was an offhanded comment. I talked to him later. He didn't even remember telling me this, but it sustained me for a long time. He very thoughtfully and softly said to me, well, you know, life is meant to be an adventure. And what that said to me was, this is going someplace. This will be in my rearview mirror one day. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where I'm headed. I don't know how I'm going to get out of this, but I will. And that was extremely helpful to me to have him say those simple words of, well, like, and he didn't say it in any pejorative manner at all. It was, life is meant to be an adventure. I thought, yeah, boy, this is, you know, mm-hmm. I'll never signed up for this one. That was very helpful. The one thing that was extremely unhelpful to me, I could be wrong, but I attribute these awful comments to the fact that people thought they could say anything to me because I'm a psychologist. It's like, oh, you can handle it. You know, you're supposed to be used to. They just were rude. I mean, I had this one guy say to me, I was at my neighbor's when I finally started coming out of my shell. She was having a backyard barbecue and invited me over, and I went reluctantly, but I did because my face had been all over the news. Everybody knew who I was. And this guy who was drunk came up to me and said, well, I hear it was a home run. Yeah, that was awful.
Uh-huh. Oh my God.
And my mother-in-law made it worse. She was kind of in denial the whole time. She never came to trial. She never read the papers. She always attributed everything to some weird blackmail theory. I mean, she was kind of off. Mm-hmm. The next following our anniversary, which would have been our 11th wedding anniversary, she sent me a happy anniversary card. And I thought, what? You talk about denial. This is a wedding I should celebrate? Like, is she kidding?
Wow.
I'm so mad. I ripped it up into confetti and put it in an envelope and sent it back to her. And on the outside, I said, I will not celebrate a marriage to a whoremonger because the woman that helped kill him was a prostitute. Yeah. That was the last of our communication, which means that murders kill families too. I mean, they cause divides in people taking sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, you know, grief and death can, it just, even if it's not a murder, can it changes regular families. And so regular is the wrong word, but someone who dies of natural causes, it's still like, you know, my dad's house was the house we had Christmas at. So Christmas is, and it's just like weird. It changes. If you could share anything else that you think would be useful for the audience to know. And you know, your story, as we've discussed, and I'm sure you've said, it sounds like a movie. Like, I've never spoken to anyone who's experienced something like this firsthand. So thank you so much for sharing this. But is there any, like, last reflections on grief you want to share, advice, just anything you think the audience would find valuable?
If you know of somebody who's grieving, and it's, of course, assuming you know them well enough to do this, don't lose track of them. Check in with them from time to time. Offer concrete things to do for them. Mm-hmm. Ask them to tell stories to you about the deceased or you volunteer stories you know about the deceased. Bring up their name. Don't let them fade into oblivion, because many people feel like everybody's forgotten about the person that they're grieving. And that's not the case, I don't think. I think people just don't know what to say, so they don't bring it up. But do bring up their name. Ask them how they're doing. And if they're angry, don't take it personally, because many grief survivors are exhausted. They're frustrated, and you may be close enough to them where they feel like they can let down their guard and be angry at you and snap at you. Don't take it personally. It's part of the grief process. If they look a little haggard, that's part of the normal thing too. And I would encourage people going through grief to connect with other people, like through your podcast or books or whatever they can do, and realize that they're not alone, that this is a normal process of what people go through when someone dies. It's not unique to them. And the more they understand, I think the more relaxed they will be about it. So if they have nightmares, it won't freak them out. Or if they have grief spasms where they find something they're not expecting to, and they find something that belonged to their person who was deceased, and they suddenly melt, that's normal. It doesn't mean you're weak. It's just part of the process. I don't think all people need formal therapy who've been through a grief process. When it becomes necessary is when it starts turning to substance abuse, when you can no longer work, when you are it's causing such strong divisions that you're contemplating divorce. Those are some of the red flags that would be like, maybe I should get some professional help on this. But I think most of the time you don't. I think most of the time you need time. And you need the comfort of a soft shoulder to cry on, and you'll come through it. You will. I never thought I didn't know how I was going to get on the other side of this, but I never had a doubt that I would. And looking back on it, I would do some things different, but I was flying by the seat of my pants as best I could. And thank God I had, as I said, my parents and Detective Landeros, and also my mentor, who was very insightful and very helpful to me. You can't get through this alone. You can't, you're not built that way. You're not wired that way. And it's hard under COVID, because people who've lost people during this COVID crisis, maybe to COVID or some other condition, they're forced to isolate. So try, you know, there's things that even they can do though, to reach out through the media. Or there's, for example, where I live, there's a group of seniors who meet in a parking lot at Home Depot wearing masks, and they bring their lawn chairs and they talk and they have coffee every morning. There's ways to connect. You have to be a little creative. But I think interconnectedness is the biggest advantage of coming on the other side of this than anything else you can do.
I totally, totally agree. There was so much great advice in what you just said. So thank you so much. Mm-hmm. If we could, you could talk a little bit about your book, what motivated you to write it. It's out now. It's called A Life Divided. Right. What you hope readers get out of it. I'm always so impressed with people who write books, because I thought like, oh, I'll write a book about grief, but like a podcast is way easier. So that's what I did. But if you could talk a little bit about that, and congratulations for the release.
I set out to do this. I decided I wanted to make it as, put one foot squarely in the subjective camp. I wanted people to understand it subjectively, what it felt like, what I thought, what I saw, what the subjective experience was like to go through this whole thing, leaving no stone unturned. But at the same time, I also planted another foot, and I wanted it to be as accurate as I could. So I read 11 pounds of court testimony. I went back to Detroit and visited the route of where everything happened twice. I interviewed police. I even interviewed my family. I took notes. I went through old video clippings. Video news footage. I went through crispy old newspapers. I put out photos in front of me. I mean, I have a background in research, right? That's what a PhD does to you. So it was second nature. It wasn't that part wasn't hard, but I wanted it to not just be my memory relying on, cause you know, it was 30 years ago and I was pretty foggy in the beginning from lack of sleep. So I wanted it to be accurate, and I wanted it to send the message that this isn't unique to me, that all homicide survivors and other people involved with the grief journey have something in common. So what I wanted to come out of this was there's a message of hope that if I can do this, so can other people. And it took me years to write it and review it, and it's been well received. I hope that if somebody were to read it, that they would be able to see themselves in it. That, you know, if it could happen to me, it can happen to somebody else. I'm not a person that seeks out drama, that led a risky life, and yet homicide touched me. And I found through my podcast that it can touch so many people who are just having normal lives. Mm-hmm. But the book was, I did not write it to feel a sense of closure, because one, there is no closure. And two, if I was going to get my ducks in order, I wanted to do it well before I wrote the book, so that I'm not using it in substitution for therapy for myself. Mm-hmm. And I'd supplanted many photographs. I think there's about 40 different photographs in the book to try to get across the messages that I, the accompanying the passages. And as a result, it turned out to be, I wasn't intending this in the beginning, but it turned out to be really a threefold story. It was my story. It was also the story of homicide survivors and how that whole network has changed over the last 35 years. And also was the story of the history of Detroit in the Cass Corridor area, because that part of the city has changed dramatically since I was there. And a lot of that's been lost to history with buildings torn down. And I mean, at the time I lived down there when I was a student, the Cass Corridor was always a part of my life. And the Cass Corridor is where my husband was murdered. It's a red light district. It's a high crime area. It's where I went to undergraduate school. It's where I was born. Before I met my husband, I had an $80 a month apartment there. It's the only thing I could afford because I had to pay my own tuition. And it was so scary living there that I put my mattress on the floor away from the windows because I'd hear automatic weapons at night right outside my window. And in the daytime, it was like everybody's dressed in there. This is right. The world headquarters of General Motors was right there. The Fisher mm-hmm. Building was right there. It's like a jewel of a beautiful area in the day. But don't go down there at night. There were rats. I mean, I can't even begin to explain how awful that area was. And the area that he was killed in, there was 1,300 prostitutes within a three-mile square area.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was just an awful sewer of an area. And so it's changed dramatically over the last 35 years. And so the book kind of chronicles that as well. And I recommend, if anybody wanted to get an idea what it's like, to watch the Netflix Low Winter Sun. It was all filmed there before all these buildings were torn down. And it's pretty accurate in terms of the lay of the land, not the police story so much. Mm-hmm. But the Cass Corridor is pretty accurately depicted there. But I'm happy with the book. I certainly revised it enough times that I could practically memorize it. It turned out to be a little longer than I'd hoped, but it's so far been well received. The full title is A Life Divided, Psychologist's Memoir About the Double Life and Murder of Her Husband.
Okay, amazing. And so if you want to tell people where else to find you online, the name of your podcast, anything else?
My podcast is called The Domino Effect of Murder. Mm-hmm. It is published through the consortium called the Mental Health News Radio Network, which is about 75 different shows, all related to mental health, whether it's substance abuse, grief, first responders, and PTSD. There's all kinds of topics in there. It is now heard in 7 countries, and of course, mostly English-speaking, but it is heard mm-hmm. in 7 countries. And I thought I would have a shortage of lists of people to interview, but sadly I'm not. They come my way. I mean, it's a mixed feeling. I feel grateful that they're there, but sad that there are so many out there. But I've interviewed some amazing people, and they're all so different. I come away learning something from each and every one of them. And if nothing else, what their episodes reinforce in me, and hopefully to the listeners, is the importance of resilience. These people are amazing, what they've come back from, whether it's because they have done scholarships, they have written books. There's one fabulous book I would recommend people to read if they're ever in this situation. It's called What to Do After the Police Leave. And it's written by a homicide survivor. And there's no other book like it out there. And it's so well done that now some police departments hand it out to homicide survivors at the scene.
Wow. Great.
And so, yeah, come on board if you want to have a listen. And we're going to be ready for season 2 in January. And it's going to kick off in January with some interviews of people from the Pulse nightclub massacre.
Okay. So, yeah, that definitely sounds very, I know I said this the first time we talked, interesting feels like the wrong word to use, but I feel compelled to listen to it, I guess. So thank you so much. I'm so glad we connected. I'm so glad that this worked and you could share your story.
And I'm glad you are doing the same.
Thank you everyone for listening. If you want to find us online, we're at www.thegriefcoach.co, on social at the_griefcoach. And if you like the podcast, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, and that helps other people find it who need content like this. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.